This is abstract art. This is like
Yeah.
Jackson Pollock or
Yeah,
something.
let's
We
do
just
some gold digging and let's find if we can find some gold.
we're just gonna smatter ideas on the canvas here and see if
So,
somebody come up with a masterpiece.
yeah. So the thought that I had was, nobody knows really what metamodernism is, right? It's like we're still trying to find out what it is.
You
And
may be trying to find what it is, but I have.
no, but I mean, if you look at the discourse,
Yeah.
so it's very much, there's no broad consensus about what it is. Everybody has a feeling, everybody has a desire, everybody has to, like an idea, but it's not really coherent. And so what people, commonly refer to as like this kind of oscillation thing between, different modes of sincerity and irony and stuff like that. And I was wondering if there's something, where this kind of oscillation model doesn't work anymore. So then I was thinking about what is, our most fundamental abstraction or conception about the world, right? So we were talking about woman is the world. So let's talk about what is the world, what is the most fundamental assumption about the world that we have? It's not really well thought out, but I'm just trying to formulate the thought. So, for example, is the world in the most fundamental thing, is it benevolent or malevolent? Is it toxic or not? Because you can have the most fundamental assumption that the world is a good place, right? And so, but you can also have like the idea that it is not. Because if you look at the world as it is, it's like in 99.9% of the whole universe, it's not conducive to life. It's like just on this tiny planet, on this outskirt of the Milky Way, we're kind of protesting against the toxicity of life of the universe, right? And so it's like, so what is it? Is the universe something through evolution that is kind of benevolent and kind of wants to foster us, or are we protesting? What is, is it just, a freak accident that we're here? And in most cases, we're not able to survive. And so you can't really have both ways. Either it is benevolent or it's toxic.
Why
And
can't you
so,
have it both ways? Why can't you say the horror, and the beauty, simultaneously? Why do you have to choose? Why can't it be both?
yeah, that's the question. Can it be both?
Well, I would say yes, but because you said you have to, it has to be one or the other, and. And I would say no. It could be like a superimposing of both, kind of like the way a wave can be a wave and a particle at the same time. I don't know, but that's just silly, naive physics. But your question sort of is like big, like I just begs me to ask why does it have to be one or the other? Why do we have to choose that particular?
Yes, because I was thinking about, okay, is there something in the universe that is not oscillating or as well as? Is there something fundamental where, the metamodern paradigm kind of fails to address? So that was my thinking. And it's like, of course, I can understand your argument. Of course it is kind of both. But then again, that's not the intellectual exercise that I'm trying to do. I'm trying to, because I could say, okay, the kind of spiritual approach to things is, sure, we are living in a kind of paradise, and all this culture war thing and wars in general, the ugly truth is, yeah, maybe we are living in paradise already. I can understand this kind of spiritual argument also, right? But then again, if we're looking at the universe as a whole, it's not really conducive and, you know, beneficial to life. It is not.
Yeah, it reminds me of, is the world like, benevolent, in the sense of the movie Avatar, where out there's these beautiful places with noble savages, and or actually even here there was once that, and we human beings are the cancer which destroys everything, and that's kind of an ecological argument these days. And then there's the other argument where nature is just this land, it's just a blind and dangerous and cold and predatory place, and
Right.
our job is to find some kind of safety and build some kind of nice utopian bubble within this dark, horrific universe.
Right.
Yeah, so we have these are just narratives, but again, I think it's a superimposed thing. I think they're both half true, and they're both half wrong. They're not absolutes. They're both, because it's like you look at the world and you see what's going on, and you just have to be like Kurtz and go, the horrors, and then it's spring in Paris, and there's this beauty every exploding everywhere, and you're like, it just stops you, and you're just like, you want to weep. So it's like, it's both.
Yes, again, I do see that argument too, right? It's just that, yeah, and I mean, I'm just Schopenhauer, for example. He was a kind of nihilist, and he thought that the only way to escape the darkness and the terror
Life is
and
suffering.
yeah, the suffering of existence is through art, right? And through the beauty of art, and you can, you know, blossom of the cherry tree. You know, springtime in Paris, a beautiful vagina, whatever, you know. So
I knew you were going there.
no, but
Or the vagina dentata, the vagina with teeth, or whatever it's called. The
I don't know if that's a thing of joy. If she threatens to bite your dick off, so that's I don't know. But again, it's like even if you look at, and you mentioned that, even if you look at nature and the, you know, the dangers and the, you know, the peculiarities about what it means to be a biological being, you know, you come into life and then you're like in the process of dying from, you know, from the get-go. You know, our social routines, you know, we're constantly, you know, falling back to these kind of warlike states. We shouldn't, but we're still doing this. We are fighting with each other everywhere. Like even in these elite kind of places like metamodernism, where people just, you know, show not their best kind of self. So we're like weird beings. You know, even if we try to do good. And so it's you know, you can find a very dark outset for life, you know. And so, you know, and then again, but then you have, you know, you can have like a spiritual experience of, you know, overmind, or what Aurobindo called supermind, and you have like this kind of ecstasy and wholeness and whatever frame you use for this. So I do see that it's both. But
Well, I know that the Chögyam Trungpa, the meditation master, he was saying the worst idea that the West ever came up with was the idea of original sin, right? That there's something flawed and bad and terrible about reality as it is.
right.
And he said that, this needs to be replaced with goodness, but not goodness like good versus bad in any moral sense, but just primordial goodness of like the color red. You can't argue with the color red. You can't say that it's bad. You can't say that it's evil. It's just primordially good because it's the color red, and you can't argue with it. There's nothing to argue with. So he had this notion that It's like this basis of goodness, right? And then we kind of fuck it up all the time
No.
because we're sort of damaged beings, I think. I mean.
And I was thinking about, I mean, there is this idea, mythologically speaking, that the universe is to be represented as female, and so, and that is
Embodiment,
that,
yeah.
yeah, and that, and so I was thinking about, so you have, everybody wants to have a nice relationship, right? And so we have like this kind of safety thinking where we think, you should, notice red flags. You shouldn't be involved with a toxic woman, right? But it's like if you want to learn something fundamental and real about women in
Go
general,
and
and
date a
about yourself,
toxic woman. That's
yeah, and about yourself,
your
yeah, and about yourself, you should get involved with a toxic woman, because if you just date a nice woman, you will never get outside of what's culturally accepted, and what's in the confines of what is safe. If you really want to know what a woman and what you are like, you have to date a toxic woman. But then again, you can make the same argument about the world. If you really want to know what the world is, you have to leave the safe pathways.
You have to get hurt.
Yes,
You have to be
exactly.
injured, you have to get
Exactly.
injured. I mean, I think
Exactly.
that, well, I wouldn't say toxic woman, because that's like, I would say just that a woman sort of challenges often a man's naivety about existence and his conceptual certainty. And often that's what women do. And that's like, that's not toxic. That's beautiful. It just doesn't fit into man's kind of plan of how the world should be. And so he gets really fucked up about that, and then sort of needs to figure out how to live in an embodied way, and not in his world of conceptual abstraction.
Yeah. Yeah,
Like
this is also
men are
true.
so abstract all the time, and so ambitious, and they have so many ideas all the, and they get so disconnected in that realm that. That I think the woman is like, you have to go through a birth process, often when you meet a woman, because you have to, first you have to make sacrifices of your perfect conceptual utopia, and you have to deal with the nitty-gritty of
No.
children and all these things. And so yeah, it's the realism that the woman brings to the world in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, what I mean with toxic is, a way of addressing the dark triad, and say they're like way out of in the spectrum of, like, let's say Machiavellianism or narcissism or psychopathy. Because, and I mean,
No, I know
yes,
what you mean then. Yeah, for sure.
generally female have this quality, to challenge men and and their ways in a good way. But what I mean is, if you really engage with a woman with really dark traits, you learn something about the soul of all
Yeah,
of
I
us.
agree with that as well. And
So,
I
and
think I've lived that as well. So I think I've
right.
experienced that. I
Yes.
think that is a big part of who I am, is just, I fell naively into a marriage, and got caught up in the madness, and everything just fucking fell apart completely,
Yeah.
My whole identity just was kind of destroyed. I think that was the best thing that happened to me in retrospect.
Yeah.
While it was happening, it was terrible, really
Exactly.
terrible, right?
Yeah.
I think a lot of men have that experience. And I guess women, I would have to talk to a woman to talk about their experience, from, I almost feel like the conversation's a bit unfair, because I'd like to hear like what a woman would say about that. Meeting a toxic
Well, but
man or
that's
something like that,
that, but that's the issue, because, like, from my experience, if you have a good moment with a woman, it's like they will admit to that. Normally they don't admit that, but if you really, really, I don't mean like engage. I mean, I'm not having a relationship. I mean, just get involved. Let's try to find out. There is something evolutionary that, you know, women are evolutionary primed to be manipulative to a certain degree. You know, that might vary more or less with every woman, but there is, you know, something that developed over the millennia to kind of become on par with men, because men were always stronger. You know, women had to do what men said they should do, and to be, you know, manipulative and scheming and conniving and all these kind of things, Machiavellian kind of style. That's just a survival mechanism that is embedded, I think, in every woman to a certain degree, with some women more, with some women less. But there's all, and you have to.
In men too, I mean. I don't think of it as like in every woman. I think of it as more as like there's degree in the feminine principle, which is in men and women. I think of it something like that. So I don't want to be too strictly dichotomous that way. Like, I see what you mean.
I want to be dichotomous.
I know you do.
Because I think, you know, the female social intelligence is way higher than that of men.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can perfectly be with a group of guys without for hours, even days, or if you like on a hunting party, like whatever, without, you know, the mechanism of, you know, manipulating and scheming coming even up once. But a woman can't, you know, turn it off. They can tone it down, but they can't turn it off. And this is, I think, they're evolutionary primed to do this. And I think
there's a question of violence, I guess. It's like men do violence, and then this is how women do violence. Yes,
exactly.
In the social realm, you know, men do violence in the outer realm, and women sort of do violence in the social realm. That's why we're all so fucked up, right?
Right. And I think, you know, if a woman, there are these moments when women, when they're like feeling, you know, it's a trusted environment, and if they're feeling like sharing or whatever, or when it's beneficial to them, then they will admit to that. But to really, not only to grasp the concept, but to really understand, to see it, you have to get involved at least for a moment with a real toxic woman to see what that is about. You know, it's like, and I don't, that's my argument. It's like, you know, if
About a guy, what about a manipulative guy who a wife beater type person? What about him? Like, would a woman say the same thing about a man? Like, you have to get involved with a real psychopathic man. I don't think she would. That would be different.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like the kind of psychopathic men who beat women, and then, you know, and the women stay with them, and it's like that's a different, that's on the other extreme. That's Machiavellian manipulative, but in a particular way, which is sort of different than perhaps the toxic women that you're talking about. I'm just trying to level the playing field here a little bit. So it doesn't sound like we're talking shit about women or something.
No,
you know
I'm not.
What I mean? No, I know. It's, you know, I understand what you're saying.
It's just what I could have made a different example, because from my point of view, we are still talking about if the universe is benevolent or not. Uh-huh. That's the starting point of this argument. I could easily made a different argument where I say, well, you know, to really know what war is, you have to do it. You can't philosophize about this. It's the same thing. It's the same argument, right? Mm-hmm. So what is like war is one of those things that are so outside of the norm of daily
and terrible to contemplate in. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's like you can philosophize, but to really understand what it means, and that you can get to a point where this that you I think I've read this like from from a psychologist, and he talked about, you know, the ability of men to self-sacrifice for the unit, you know, for the
Yeah.
battalion or whatever,
Yeah.
because the embodiment of the feeling that you are the US Army, and even if you die, the US Army and therefore you will continue. And this is like an ex embodied experience that you can't really have in daily life, right? So
Yeah.
and so the self-sacrifice in war is something that we outside of that never really can understand what that means, right?
Yeah, I remember reading James Hillman, and he has a very good essay about that. And he talks about some general, I don't know, General MacArthur or something, and he's going on the battlefield, and he's declaring how much he loves war, like just with his whole heart, that war really is, and that, it's like it's hard for us in the civilized world to sort of understand that, because that's human beings at their most extreme. I have no taste of that, myself, but it was an interesting thing to read that maybe on some level we have to find some, we have to, and I don't know, get in touch with our own violence on that level. I don't know if I've articulated that very well,
Yeah,
but
but I mean, chimps go on hunting parties and they're like on, it's like so part and ingrained in our DNA to be violent beings. And
yeah.
it's like we're so disconnected from that. But there is, you know, this urge that we have to do that again and again. And it's like from an enlightened mind, it's like, okay, why are we doing this?
And it doesn't seem
Again.
just like a death drive. That seems too simplistic, because there's something
Right.
like heroic about it, and terrible as well. War is something that's it's just impossible to contemplate, from our own particular perspective. It seems to me it's like it's just one of those things that's you just can't contemplate. You can't wrap your head around.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I mean. It's like if you go to the extremes, either with a woman or with war or whatever, you get to understand an aspect of the universe that is not part of the normal way of doing things of
Right, you get the rug pulled out from under you
Yes.
completely.
Yes.
And that's sort of a valuable experience to have, which I guess it gets you out of your narrow ego centric view, or just limited perspective of reality. It's just it takes you to a almost a spiritual place, right?
Right.
If you want to call it that. Because psychedelics, for example, people talk about psychedelics being some sort of like pleasure, like tripping, right?
Yeah.
But actually, like, the bad trips are often the most valuable to people, because they see the horror of the situation, as Gurdjieff calls it,
Yeah.
and that wakes them up to a whole new level of conscientiousness about what being our lives are about. So something like that. Yeah. So maybe what you're describing as like a really just being thrust out of the ordinariness of your
Right.
existence. And that's what, the crazy woman, or the terrible, a taste of war, or you can have that anywhere, actually. You could have it in the most banal suburb. You can experience that kind of horror, right? In the
Right.
most, you don't have to go to war for that, really. I mean, it is potentially possible everywhere, right?
Yeah.
The horror and the sublime, Jarvecki talks about that, are very intertwined.
And you know what the weird thing is? It's like if we take a Jungian perspective, you know, and get rid of all the superficial surface description of why somebody or a state does something, and you just look at what happens actually, and then you look at, you know, all these kind of young female politicians, you know, beginning in their 40s, mid 40s. As a politician, fairly young from my point of view, you know, because, you know, you need to be like an elder or a great statesman, you have to be 50 or 60 or stateswoman, whatever. you can't be really like an experienced politician with mid-40s, but there is this breed at the moment of female politicians in that age that kind of escalate purposefully the conflict with the Ukraine and Russia, you know? And
Oh,
you have
really?
the yeah, and you have the German foreign minister, and then you have, you know, the Estonian woman, and all they're kind of strangely calling for war. And it's like, and I don't, and I, I'm and I'm looking at this, and I'm trying to abstract this and disconnect it from what they're saying, and try to see the evolution, if there's an evolutionary drive behind this, you know. And
You
so it's
mean
like,
women pushing men to war?
yeah, and why would
Huh.
they do that?
Why would they do that?
That's the question. Why?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess you said Jungian, so my first thought was animus, right? This intensely ambitious quality that, this animus that women sometimes get stuck with. And then the guys become anima. They become kind of slavish to the feminine principle. They become kind of slaves to. They become yes men. They become corporate yes men, to powerful women usually.
Yeah.
So there's this kind of anima. Yeah, the anima and the animus take over. I think the Jungian analysis is very good, because you see a lot of animus arising in women, and then you see a lot of this sort of intensely maternal men and sensitive men, defensive men, and these days.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know, maybe it's just me, because what I, sorry to, it's like I'm ranting somewhat, but I'm trying still to find a point here. Because, you know, if you look at what, especially, I mean, from my point of view, but I guess it's true for all of Europe, if you look at what happens between Ukraine and Russia and the rest of Europe, or America for that matter, you know, it's like everybody is blind to a certain process of escalation that happens for 1 or 2 years now. So it's like Germany has, you know, it started with, oh no, we're sending some weapons, and then the tanks, and now we're sending like rockets. And now, you know, there's this big discussion about, you know, oh, what happened? So there was like the Russians, they actually leaked a secret, you know, recording they made of German generals, which were talking about, oh, what would happen if we like straightforwardly attack, you know, Russian buildings in Russia. And so everybody is like, oh, how did they get, you know, this recording? But the point is not, you know, the leaking of the recording, but the German generals were like openly talking about attacking Russia. And this is insane. And then they're wondering why Russia is like part of this escalation spiral. And nobody's looking at the escalation spiral, but just looking at why some, it's like in a bad marriage. I do this because you do this, and you do this because I do this. And but it's like if you look at it, you know, from a distance perspective, it's like, why is there like an escalation spiral in the first place? And why is not is aren't there like concerted efforts of the statesmen, of stateswomen, you know, to go there and to try to work on a peace treaty? That's not happening. So why is there like an evolutionary drive towards war?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, if you read Gurdjieff, he would say that people are asleep, and I and that there's nothing you can do. It's kind of weird, but I sometimes feel that way. Maybe that's a very defeatist sort of attitude. There are things that people should do, but the peace in the First World War led to the Second World War, right? We try to make peace, and that often leads to another war. So whatever the karma is, it has to be fully, I would call it karma, just the action of whatever is going on. It reaches a point of no return, and then just whatever plays itself out, plays itself out. I don't think people will kind of like disagree with that,
Yeah.
like what happened in Israel, you know. It's just like horror upon horror is the next stage, and then you make peace, and then what happens? Oh, then you have global terrorism. Like, you know, what do you do? Like, what do you, you know, there's no way out of that cycle once you get started, it would appear. So it has to exhaust itself in some way. So maybe peace treaties are just in, you know, sometimes peace treaties are just pushing the conflict even further down the line, you know, and that over years and years, you know, Gaza, how long has been Gaza been going on, and how many million of people have died, and how many people will die if we keep having peace treaties? I mean, that's a cynical point of view, perhaps, but because obviously the goal is peace, but you don't, you just have to, you don't, I mean, I'm not a, you know, I'm not a, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. You know, there seems to be like this thing called war in the world, and I don't know what to, you know, what to do about it.
No, you know, we talked last time about, you know, Terrence Malick, you know, the Thin Red Line, and that's basically a meditation about the, you know, about the predator, the nature, the nature, the true nature of nature itself. You know, that it's predatory and dangerous, and that it takes life from you everywhere you look. You know, it takes life. It is life. But it's like if you look at it from that point of view, as the cosmos being like a malevolent force that eats itself up, war seems to me like a sacrifice, you know, to the orders of the universe, just to live a little bit more longer. You know, that's what it seems to me. If we're talking about, you know, a religious kind of frame, you know,
Yeah, the Sufis would say that you have to create kind of samadhi or concentration in order, you know, that's a sacrifice to God or whatever, right? Yeah, and if you don't do that, war is inevitable.
you know, but I mean it differently. I mean it that the war itself is the sacrifice to the gods of the cosmos. You know,
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, how do we avoid that? Well,
no,
you know, we
but you
could.
can't.
Yeah, maybe that's the only way you can, is kind of like what Krishnamurti says, like it's happening within yourself, so you have to make your own sacrifice. So spiritual intelligence, you know, is for me is the only kind of remedy, real remedy to these sort of things, because otherwise the scapegoat mechanism, you know, as Girard calls it, just keeps rearing its head, and you know, over and over again, and it just never ends. But there's something profound about making yourself the offering, or the scapegoat, or the, you know.
No, I mean the thing we talked about Dune, but the general, the most general idea of these six books is that, you know, humanity has to be controlled by a God King, and billions of people have to get killed in order for the golden path to emerge, for in order for humanity to survive in the long run. You know, so the whole 10,000 years, or 20,000 years, how long, 12,000 years, where the story unfolds and where these billions of people are killed, is the sacrifice that is necessary for humankind to survive. That's the general idea of book four and book five. You
That
know,
sounds
that's
like pure paganism, the Moloch or whatever, you know, the child eating god, or you know. I think
Yes,
that is our nature,
yes.
but on the primitive level. I think there is a way to transcend it, but I, you know, I don't think it's simple. I don't think it's like, I don't think you can do it at the UN, for example, you know.
No, but again, it's like we're still, because you're saying like people are sleeping. I think we're still only all we are. We're still waking up. You know, we all have this ideas about, you know, of enlightenment and ethical behaviors, and, you know, it's like how we should behave, and morals and whatnot. But we still haven't wrestled fully with the true nature of the universe.
Or with the true nature of ourselves, in the Gurdjieffian sense, are like our three brains, you know. They tend to work separately from each other, right? So war is a symptom of that lack of relationship between all the different parts of our nervous system.
Yeah, but again, it's like which one is the most fundamental assumption about the universe? Is it that war is an essential part that will always be there, as long as humans exist, or is war a result of a dysfunction between these three kind of selves? So that's because it's like that's the question.
So that yeah. Is, so is it, or is it just pure natural? War is just naturalism. But it doesn't seem to me that like war is supernaturalism. war is something, you know, supernatural. It's not something natural. I mean, because conflict is natural, but the way we do war right now is, I think it is a symptom of our profoundly dissociated state.
See, and then you have like an assumption which is not oscillating anymore. This is your basic assumption about the world.
Right. So we have to, I guess, yeah, I guess maybe we do have to make that assumption. Like we do have to say, we do have to plant our flag and say, you know, not just be fatalistic and, you know, it's kind of like not just fall back into the matrix and fall asleep in the matrix. We have to sort of, you know, we have to plant our flag. I remember, you know, Gaffney was talking about how at Esalen in the hippie times, they're saying nobody captures the flag. You know, everything is kind of like, but then this relativism and this acceptance and this kind of flaky kind of like a acceptance of all values and stuff. It doesn't appear to, it results in kind of its opposite at some point. So then there has to be a value being proclaimed, right? On some level.
It's like everybody has to make that choice for themselves. You know, you have to put your flag somewhere in the ground. Just for argumentative purposes, you know, to be the advocatus diaboli, I could say, well, maybe a better way would just be accept, you know, that the nature is predatory itself and that war is a, you know, fundamental basic building block of human society. And that the only way to deal with this, to develop like an heroic and integrative way to deal with this, you know, and to accept, you know, that existence is dangerous and predatory, like on which scale you are, like
with yeah, women, but that's too. That's not. That doesn't have enough vision to it. It seems like I would more say like Chogyam Trungpa, victory over war, right? Is victory over war possible? Well, we don't know, but that's what we should be aiming for. We should be aiming for something. We shouldn't just accept the status quo.
But that's what I mean with being heroic, you know, to be like to you know, not suffer, but because of war or because of that part of our essential nature, but to say, oh no, I'm finding a way to at least within myself bring that to peace, to you know what Wilbur would say, to integrate and transcend it in a kind of way.
You have to integrate the warrior for sure. You have to come to terms with the violence for sure. If you push that away, you know, the hippie world doesn't work. You know, you try to push that away and say, oh, what's wrong with the world, let's make a nicer world, it's just that's no. You know, you right. really have to grapple with, we have to grapple with our violence. And not just the violence of war, but the violence of sort of like everyday life, you know, the violence of peace, you know, the violence of life in, you know, a little town like where I live, a village in France. It's like the violence of schools, for example, like the violence of education. Yeah. You know, and Beelzebub, his biggest critique almost of human beings is the education. And he says that's what's, you know, that's this is what distorts our reality so badly is kind of the way that we are educated. And I think, yeah, so something about that, something about our education system and what the education means, and it's, I think it leads to that development of what you were talking about before about the animus and the anima kind of arising and ruling the world through unconscious what? I don't know, unregulated, unconscious libidinous energy or something.
I mean, it's interesting that you bring the social and cultural life in, because I mean, I was just reading something about Judith Butler and critical theory and stuff, and so to, you know, to view everything as a power discourse, you know, mm-hmm. and is itself an oppressive act, you know, to the idea to get out of, you know, the gender duality, let's say, and force that view basically on everybody, spoon fed. It's also like an act of power, an act of violence. And so you can't, you always have that. You always have struggle. You always have conflicting forces, conflicting powers to be, you know, it's like there's no
complementarity. It's just men versus women or something, it's, you know, trying to.
No, that's not what I mean. I mean just discourse in general, you know. Mm-hmm.
Discourse.
Even if you say
about power, yeah. Do we want power? You know, what do we want? Like, that's the question. It's like, I guess you want power. Like, you feel good when you have power, but I think it's more like you feel good when you have inspiration and when you have, you know, when you're, like, when we're talking and something interesting is arising in our conversation, and it's not about power. It's about unveiling more truth in the world and reality, and you know, that's, it's not about, like, we're not like, not sometimes perhaps our egos are involved with each other and we want to have power over each other a little, but we're adults, so we push that aside and we get to the what really matters, and that is the discourse between us and the dialogue, logical insights that arise in our conversation, right? So what?
Yeah, but that's
power.
What,
like, who cares? If, I mean,
that was not what I was talking about. I was talking about, you know, this idea of critical theory, that lots of our scientific or philosophical insights came from white Western males, and that created a, you know, like a cultural power that kind of suppressed, you know, other ways of knowing, other ways of thinking. And that's so the whole idea that that biology is an oppressive system is because it's based on the powers of white men and the ideas of these men that they had. And so,
well, that's just not, I don't understand what that means. I mean, we can criticize, you know, white men, colonial powers, but that just sounds like garbage thinking to me.
Yes, I'm just saying, it's like every time you create a frame of conversation and communication, it is a result of acting and embodying power and acting out of power. It's like, okay, so we have, so for, it's like every time you create an argument,
mm-hmm.
It is an act of power, because you force your partner in a way to adapt to that frame that you just made.
Mm-hmm. Which doesn't work so much in a marriage. It kind of leads to the whole thing falling apart, right? If it's just one, my power versus your power versus that, it makes no sense, that sort of thinking.
No, but it's a game. Sometimes the woman's arguments have more power, or the woman's points of view, or yours. It's like an exchange, and a marriage should have both. You know,
Yeah, but then you come to compromises that are beneficial to both of you, and you're not like, I win this argument, yay, because then she'll get you back the next time.
No, that's not what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what am I misunderstanding?
So, for example, so if you were to propose a topic for podcast,
yep,
yes, and I say, okay, let's do it, then you created a frame that I'm kind of subjected to. It is not, it's not, so, and just like, because we're playing and everything is fine, but you could make the argument that, for example, biology is a frame that is an expression of a power, power game, which kind of suppresses other ways of approaching biology and gender and sex and other ways of knowing. That's just,
well, that's ideology. That's, you could create an ideology from biology, but then you would no longer be doing biology. You'd be doing ideology, right?
Yeah, or you would do something different. Yes. Mm.
So you can take any kind of field and make it an ideology that is like, and then subject it to the culture war.
The only thing I want to say is that even the most peaceful idea and the most peaceful conversation is oppressing to some people. That's all that I'm saying, you know?
Oh, okay.
And so you can't get rid out of conflict, even in the most peaceful conversation.
Sure. So I don't know. I'm feeling really oppressed by what you're saying right now. Just kidding.
Yeah.
Not at all, but...
No.
Yeah. I think we need to take some time out. Let's just I'm just gonna go to my safe space right now for a while and you know.
No, but I mean, again, it's like it's very it's not very well thought out thoughts, but I was thinking, it's like, okay, so what are our basic assumptions about the world? That women are good, you know, that men are pigs, that women are like pure beings, you know, that have to be on a pedestal, or what is it? Or what is the world? Is the world something that supports you? Is it like something that you have to wrestle with? You know, it's like, I think.
So are you talking about women or are you talking about the world here? Are those the exact same subject?
No, in a way, I think it's the same subject.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so woman is the subject of man, and man is the subject of woman in a way. Like, it's where we live, it's what we, you know, in the most kind of like basic way.
Women invented patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Because they see the universe as a man.
And we invented matriarchy because we see the woman, you know, is that what follows? I'm a bit lost when it comes to the whole business of like discussions of patriarchy and matriarchy and because I think,
mean,
like,
But what I generally mean is that the other sex is always the other. You know, it's like,
yeah.
You know, it's for us men, the universe is female. It's not male. You know, it's like what you try to do when you go into meditation. You try to find non-duality or whatever. But non-duality, the space, the void, it's female.
Yeah. So you in a way when you're doing meditation, it's a form of sex with the universe kind of thing.
Right, there you go.
You know, yeah.
I mean, it's Kali.
And
either Kali or Nuit or whatever.
Yeah, well, I wonder again about this question of sexual difference. So you describe it that way, and then I'm wondering what the female perspective of meditation would be. Would it be like to be penetrated by the universe, you know? Whereas when men do meditation, it's to sort of fuck the universe. But I think non-duality is when you kind of go, when you you lose the boundaries of those two things and they become a singularity.
We're 50 minutes into this podcast, and I feel like I'm allowed to go off the deep end now.
Okay, please.
Because
Uh-oh,
I mean
okay.
the question is, and again, talking about Dune, because there's this moment in the books at least where Paul enters, while drinking the waters of life, enters a place where a woman can't go. Okay, that's the story. What does it mean?
Like
And
Mount
so I'm,
Athos or something.
huh?
Like Mount Athos. It's a
Yeah,
place
something
in where a
like
woman can't go, yeah.
a spiritual place. And I was wondering, okay, so have you, like, do you think, oh, I must be careful now, but the point I'm trying to make is that can women and do women have that deep of an interest in meditation as men do? And I mean, in general, I know there are some women that have, but it's like in comedy.
No,
It's
they do. They do. They do. They do. It's just because my particular way, the women are much better at meditation than the men are, actually, in a lot of ways. And there's as many, when I was in the Zen tradition, there's as many Korean nuns doing it as there are. They do. Yeah. I think they
I'm
like they maybe they didn't in history, because I think because then roles were more defined in history. But I think they do it for, I think they do. I think
I
women
think
often make much better practitioners, yogic practitioners than men do. They often succeed, way better than men in it, because they have less ego when they go into the process. Maybe
I
men are stronger in general at, let's say, the more intellectual yogas, and women are more stronger in the more devotional style yogas. But
That's not my impression, Andrew. My impression is there's a place in meditation that only men can reach, and
no.
women and men have that drive to enter that, because what man wants to enter is a form of non-duality, that
No, women
women
too.
embody. No,
Both
I
my
don't.
Buddhist teachers in the beginning were women. I had a Zen teacher, an incredible meditator. That she was a Zen, monk or nun, and also I went to live in the monastery with Pema Chodron. The women were incredible. So I know I don't really think that's true.
Again, I'm not talking about individuals. I'm talking about stereotype. I'm talking about general. It's like with comedy. It's like what Christopher Hitchens said. So women are not evolutionary primed to do comedy. That doesn't mean that there are not women that excel in comedy and are better than men. Of course, there are singular women that are way better in comedy than men. But his argument is comedy developed as a way to for men, as an evolutionary way to attract females. Like if you don't have money, if you look shit, then you develop comedy and then you get yourself attractive. Women don't need to do that because we already find them attractive. And so we men are kind of evolutionary primed for comedy. And my argument would be like in a kind of similar area that, of course, women can excel in meditation. But in general, I don't think they're like primed to look for the non-dual or that kind of space that basically every man is striving for. That's what I mean. Because as Barthes said, we are looking for, with non-duality, we're looking for the big mama. That's not what women
Because
generally
they're
look
already
at.
there. They're already there. They're already
That's what I mean.
already, right? They're
That's what I
already in the
mean.
garden. So they're not like, they don't have the feeling that they've been ejected from the Garden of Eden like men
Right,
do, and that they have to get
right,
back somewhere.
right.
Something like
Go
that.
back to the big teat, It's like
Yeah.
that's not what women do. They look
Yeah.
maybe for the big cock, but they're not looking. It's like, of course they can, but it's like collectively, it's like it's a different way of drive. And if you look at just the amount of monks and people and meditators, I think the majority of people who did that were mostly men. Because it,
No, there's a lot of nuns and monks who, you know,
yeah,
there's a lot
but
of
yeah, I
nuns
mean,
out
there are a
there
lot of
too.
inst like Instagram Ibiza women that meditate, but it's not really the meditation I'm talking about, you
Yeah,
know?
no, well, I mean, like again, I've just, that's not been my experience with meditators and meditator schools. I've seen just as many women who go as far or further than men in those areas. There is a way that perhaps that if they become nuns, they have to sort of get they have to sort of let go of their sexuality, their the reproductive urge, you know, in that way. So they have to, so it's they have to kind of give up on that part of womanhood to be strong practitioners, perhaps. That might be true. And then, you know, there's a way in which, like, I think if you're pursuing spiritual practice strongly, you have to go beyond the reproductive business, or you have to at least be able to find a way to do that and go beyond it at the same time. Does that make any sense? Maybe I'm not making sense, but
Maybe I'm not making sense. I'm just trying to formulate, you know, an impression that I have. And I was thinking, what, okay, what does Herbert, Frank Herbert mean when he says Paul enters a place where woman can't go? Because again, Frank Herbert was part of the Hermetic and occult tradition. So he was trying to convey an idea there. What's the idea?
Oh,
So
well,
why?
the place that women can't go, like Mount Athos, is the mountain is the woman. That's kind of interesting. Like the place that the water is the woman, right?
Yeah, but then we're talking about the same thing. Then we don't have a con, you know, it's like
Yeah.
that's what I mean.
But
Men.
there's also spaces where the men can't go, which is when the women get together, and like in James in the not James Joyce, in the Ulysses, where the women are getting together and washing clothes, and this is a sealed area where the men can't.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about meditation now, you know?
Yeah,
I'm
well,
talking.
you think so. Your thesis is that meditation is kind of a male. I think there's more male forms of meditation, like Zen is very masculine. It's
I
like
don't know
very
what I mean.
samurai-like. And I
I
know that there's forms of meditation in the tantric tradition that have more sensual qualities, that have more feminine sort of.
yeah. I'm not, I don't know, no, I do not know what I mean. I'm just trying to find out what I mean. Because there is, like, from my feeling, there's an inherent difference. It doesn't mean that women don't meditate, and I don't mean to say that, you know, women can't achieve that, what men can achieve. I'm not talking about this. I'm talking about
No, I know, I know.
there's something, there is an inherent mama drive within men that urges them, you know, to go to the non-dual. And that's a drive that's kind of specific to men because of the anima, because like we try to, you know, develop our anima, and meditation is kind of a way to get, because the non-dual is a female big archetype, is an anima, like the biggest that you can imagine. And so we as men, we have this kind of drive, and I don't know how to. And I don't know what it is. It doesn't mean that women can't do this. Maybe it's just that in the extremes, we can enter a place that they can't, and that makes the dynamic completely different, you
Yeah,
know?
we can go and you know, hang out in front of the pyramids, whereas a woman risks to being raped if she well, that's a different thing, but yeah, this is a very interesting conversation. I'm just, you know, again, I think that women can be very powerful spiritual
Of course.
practitioners as much as men, but maybe it's just the difference between the priestess and the priest.
Right.
Because the priest has this, yeah, the priests kind of have a different quality than the priestess.
Yes.
And I think maybe we want to distinguish between those two, and that's a good thing to do, to
Yeah, that
distinguish
makes sense. Yes.
between the two. And maybe in the end they both reach the non-dual. Maybe they, I don't know. Yeah, I guess animus is, so you know, somebody told me in the yogic tradition you have to become fully masculine and fully feminine. So the men have to become fully feminine,
Yes.
And then the women have to become fully masculine, because if they're just in their, if they're lost in their
There
polarities,
you go.
you know,
Exactly.
they don't get anywhere. They're just, you know, men are just kind of like
I mean, that's the
kind
reason
of dumb,
why.
and women are kind of go crazy, and you know, women become hysterical and men become neurotic. You know, that's the
I mean, to talk about Kabbalah, that's the reason why the Queen of the Swords in the Tarot is depicted with a sword, because the sword is essentially male. And that's the reason why you have the Tree of Life, the three pillars, or the two, the pillar of strength is also female, because they have to embody. And so the function and the role of the priestess is way and much harder and stronger in a kind of way, and colder sometimes, way much colder than a man can do. And that's maybe a place where a man can't go like this, generally speaking, because the function is different. It's like the and the
I agree that the function of the priest and the priestess is different. And I guess the quality of men go to kind of these weird extremes with things. You know, I don't know how to say that, but it's expansion and reduction. So I don't know, Bina and Shokuma. Bina is the, is it? I can't remember which one it is, but there's this expansion of, you know, sperm of energy going everywhere, and then the womb, female womb, you know, is this reduction. It brings it, you know, into. So there's always this dynamic going on between, you know, multiplicity and you know, and then reduction and severity. So the Gevura is the severe, but it, you know, it's a feminine severity which brings things into embodiment. So there's something in that.
So I'm empty now. I came now. I'm
You've come. Okay. And it's exactly 1 hour and you're German, so something in your mind is like a clock that says we have to stop now.
I came. My verbal tantra is over now.
Okay. Now you have to go lie down for a while. I don't know. Eat
I
some
pushed in
almonds.
and out, like, long enough, and my energy
Yeah,
level is
go recover and have some protein drinks and do what you need to do before the next battle.
All right, folks.
Well, that was fun.